The best in Bitcoin made audible. You're listening to Bitcoin Audible with Guy Swan. Yo, everybody, welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. This is Guy Swan, and we are reading a little bit about Bitcoin today. I got a great piece. This one is by Hasu, and many times we've read his stuff on the show. And this one's really interesting just because it's a thought experiment on how Bitcoin, a Bitcoin standard, could potentially go the way of the gold standard. And I love this sort of adversarial thinking, and Hasu is great for a lot of things just like this. And this is on the Deribit, D-E-R-I-B-I-T, if you don't know it, deribit.com. This is like their insights thing, like their blog. They have a lot of great stuff up here. And this one's not super long, but we will go ahead and jump into it. Don't forget, Swan Bitcoin is supporting this show. They are the best, lowest cost way to auto buy Bitcoin on a regular basis. And you can support the show by going to swanbitcoin.com/guy, and you'll get $10 free in your Bitcoin savings plan to start you off. So don't forget about that, swanbitcoin.com/guy. And while you are safely stacking sats, you can listen to Hasu's Why Bitcoin Might Not Survive a Bitcoin Standard from deribit.com. Why Bitcoin Might Not Survive a Bitcoin Standard. Bitcoin allows users to store and transfer value without trusting any third party. However, these assurances are constrained to 4,400 transactions per block, more if you count one-to-many payments. All else equal, Bitcoin's capacity is constrained by the block size. The current block size limit exists for technical and incentive compatibility reasons that are unlikely to go away soon. Some people posit you can scale Bitcoin by increasing the block size. While that would allow more transactions, the assurances of these transactions would be worse. Consequently, Bitcoin protects its properties by excluding usage beyond the safe capacity limit. Over time, the safe capacity limit can be expanded, for example, via additional layers, like Lightning. I'd like to challenge this orthodoxy by saying Bitcoin's ability to exclude users is smaller than commonly assumed. While Bitcoin can control the number of users inside the network, it has no control over the number of users accessing the network through custodial banks. The growth of this banking layer is outside of the protocol's control and could grow into a systemic risk for Bitcoin. Users adopt custodial banks because they offer low transaction cost over a variety of dimensions. These can include stronger network effect, faster payment clearing, legal recourse, lower transaction fees, or access to financial services like exchange or money markets. A popular vision today is that the future Bitcoin stack will consist of different layers that represent unique points on a trust cost graph. If higher layers break down, users can retreat to lower layers. In this article, I will show how a custodial banking layer creates systemic risk for Bitcoin. Then, what drives the growth of the custodial banking layer? And finally, how a negative outcome for Bitcoin could be prevented. How a custodial banking layer creates systemic risk for Bitcoin. Imagine a future where 200 million people use Bitcoin, most of them via the custodial banking layer. These banks use the base chain as an interbank settlement network. Users trade in Bitcoin IOUs, representing Bitcoin deposits. The long-term stability of this arrangement is a matter of who has leverage over whom. If users can leave at any time and go to a competitor, including the trustless layers of the system, the custodial banking system is kept in check. But if users are locked in, then the power resides with the banks, and thereby governments. Whether users are locked in or not depends on the exit cost from the system. Manual exit cost. When governments can come in and cancel the redeemability for Bitcoin, this may be seen as jacking the exit cost from the system to infinity. Governments may find it difficult to control the network layer itself, but in this example, they don't need to at all. They already control the banks. This is what happened in 1933 to the gold of U.S. citizens, and in 1971 to the gold of other nation-states held within the domestic U.S. If redeemability is canceled, Bitcoin completes the transition back to fiat money, based on Dalio's chart of the long-term debt cycle. And with this, there is a graphic of that debt cycle. And it starts with, it's the cycle of money, really. It starts with type 1 hard money, which are metal coins in this example, and it maximizes the credibility of the money, but minimizes the credit within the system. But then that moves into type 2, claims on hard money, like banknotes, for instance. And then that slowly turns into type 3, which is fiat money, like US dollars today, and that maximizes credit, but minimizes credibility. But eventually that system would fail, or at least the mitigation of its risk would send us back to type 1, hard money, in the example of this article, Bitcoin. Notably, this is not a scenario where users could user-activated soft fork or respond in any other way at the protocol level, since the rules of the Bitcoin standard still abide by the rules of the Bitcoin protocol. Users allowed it to become a political problem that now requires a political solution. Organic exit cost. In practice, governments may not even have to cancel redeemability for Bitcoin because exit cost can grow very large organically. Take a bank-run scenario where all 200 million people, or at least a significant part of them, wanted to leave the banking system and move down the stack to a more trustless layer. Some of them can successfully make the transition, but they would be the winners of an auction that jacks transaction fees to the thousands to tens of thousands of dollars. The rest would be left behind on the higher layer. If a higher layer grows too large relative to the capacity of the lower layer, people lose the optionality of moving back down the stack. As users find themselves permanently locked into a higher layer, governments can safely implement a variety of taxes or rule changes in the system. What drives the growth of the custodial banking layer? People use higher layers because they offer them more favorable points to the trust cost spectrum. Remember that cost includes many things, not just transaction fees. It also includes network effect, settlement time, reversibility, privacy, etc. I'm afraid there exists a feedback loop that makes custodial layers more attractive the larger they become, driving further users to them. This can be first shown with an example from the gold standard. Every user of gold competes with other users in the marketplace. If they can settle debts sooner rather than later, suppliers are more willing to do business with them. If banking can give them lower fees, they can forward this price saving to their trading partners. The result is a feedback loop where users migrate to the cheapest solution over time. The benefits of using a bank ledger are local and immediate, whereas the downsides are global and often happen with decades of delay. The same feedback loop exists in Bitcoin, but arguably in an even stronger way. If the custodial banking layer becomes very successful, imagine that all these settlement transactions drive up the transaction fees on the base layer. Suddenly, more and more people become priced out of using trustless layers at all. The custodians can afford to pay more for the base layer space because their transactions represent the bundled interest of thousands of users off-chain. As a result, formerly non-custodial users can find themselves facing the option to use custodial options or stop using Bitcoin altogether. This also holds for an only slightly lesser degree for the Lightning Network, where you can't safely route payments smaller than 3.5 times the on-chain fee limit. Interestingly, the feedback loop can still hold if transaction fees are very low. The reason is, again, that fees represent merely one aspect of the overall transaction costs. If the security budget of the main chain is very low, settlement times could become very excessive. This further increases the relative advantage of custodial, off-chain solutions like banks. How a negative outcome for Bitcoin could be prevented. I see two ways to minimize the systemic risk from a custodial banking layer. First, the community can discourage users from adopting IOUs on a large scale. This involves constructing a narrative where new users can still get financial exposure to Bitcoin, but not use it in a way where banks have a leg up on the trustless layers. Arguably, this has already happened in the last couple of years, and shows how well the Bitcoin community instinctively understands that Bitcoin's assurances degrade for everyone if too many people use it the wrong way. Second, we need to continue to innovate and expand Bitcoin's trustless capacity to more users. Specifically, we need to pioneer ways for multiple users to share a single UTXO, so they can also bundle their interest and survive in the on-chain marketplace for block space with custodial banks. There's an implicit assumption in Bitcoin that users will pay more to use the base layer or its trustless extensions like the Lightning Network. In practice, Bitcoin doesn't just compete with fiat money or even other cryptocurrencies, but also with custodial Bitcoin banks. I would still firmly count myself as a small blocker, but the analysis raises some doubt whether keeping validation costs low is as effective as commonly assumed. You can have a low validation cost but become forced into custodial layers by high transaction fees, very long settlement times, or other cost factors. Many in Bitcoin believe there is a big risk in moving too fast, but hardly any risk in moving too slow. This would be true if Bitcoin could grow at its own pace, but it can't. We must make sure that enough demand from the market can be met with trustless capacity, or risk that the custodial banking system will forever encumber the base layer. All right, so I want to talk about this one. I love this kind of adversarial thinking, and this is exactly the sort of, like, this is one of the most realistic perspectives on how, on that critical trade-off between the verification cost and the use cost. Because, you know, Nick Szabo has a great article about exit and freedom and how it is, in fact, the exit costs to a system and the ability to execute the trustlessness in that decentralized court. Like I use that analogy a lot, is that, you know, Bitcoin is like that decentralized court, like financial court that determines the ultimate ownership of everyone in the system. And if you have a situation where, you know, just like there is no justice, if it costs $1 million just to defend yourself in court, well then everybody who has a problem or has an injustice that is under $1 million cost, there is no justice for that person. There's no way to, end up with the correct, they don't have access to it. That's what it means. And this is a really interesting thought experiment. It's something that I think about a lot too. And I love that Hasu, everybody gives Hasu so much shit, but like, you know, this is an adversarial environment. Like, it's about tackling those tough questions. And that's the whole value or the idea of, you know, move slow and don't break things, is to make sure that you aren't rushing it and that you are considering every adversarial position, because the simple truth is we don't want to find ourselves back where gold is, or in the same position that gold put us in, because then we've not solved the problem, right? So I want to talk about this piece. I want to talk about, like, some of his assumptions, that, you know, I think we're moving in the right direction within Bitcoin, and I think there are ways to deal with these trade-offs, and I like just kind of the general perspective of how to mitigate this problem from becoming the, you know, the potential disaster that it could be. But let's go ahead and hit our sponsor real quick, and then we will jump back in and talk about this piece. So I think the most important thing in this article is how he, in the mitigation of this risk, is in trying to figure out how to have as many people as possible able to split the value or split the ownership of a single UTXO. And in the same way, somehow enable a way for a group of individuals in an on-chain marketplace, a decentralized marketplace for block space, to be able to compete with large custodial banks or financial institutions. And this is why I think the layered approach is so important, because it adjusts thinking toward exactly that way. And there is this inherent trade-off, you know, like when, as soon as you start thinking about Bitcoin and how the security of the system, how the assurances of the system are actually enforced, it is through the decentralization of its verification. So there is a natural trade-off. There is a natural balance between the ability to verify, the ability to validate it, versus the assurances that it gives. So the more data that's actually put on it, the less valuable the assurance is, the more it is trust minimized rather than trust less, or trusted rather than trust minimized. And as long as the only way to provide those assurances is through widespread decentralized verification, you know, until we have some breakthrough in that the amount of data has nothing to do with the cost of the actual validation of undeniable 100% cryptographic validation, as soon as that's no longer the truth, well, then yeah, we can get right around it. But that isn't the truth today. That isn't the truth with just the very idea of actually proving and validating. Like, this, it's kind of an inherent thing. Like, it would take a revolutionary breakthrough on the order of, you know, solving the Byzantine general's problem. There's only so much that you can, you know, compress a piece of data and actually 100% know what that data was, like, what's inside that data. As soon as you start hashing it, you can verify its history, or you can verify that it was part of something, but you're not verifying the whole data set. And that's why the accounting, the ownership layer, should be separate from the payments layer. But that does suppose a risk that, you know, if we're not focused, it could easily go the custodial route. Just like he talks about, like, you know, there's a lot of incentives, there's a lot of feedback in the custodial layer potentially providing better service than the non-custodial. And that is a risk. That is something that we don't want to happen. That's why I like that, you know, like, this is about, like, proof of keys day matters. Like, we don't want to be adopting IOUs. That's why Lightning is so powerful, is the ability to, you know, scale, get us another 5 years, you know, potentially 10 years incremental improvements on how to scale the transaction layer, on how to scale the payments themselves without compromising the verification and without having to resort to IOUs. You're still holding your keys. You're still holding all of the data needed to exit from that system. But if the cost of exit gets too high, well, then anything below that, anything below that exit cost threshold is essentially trusted. And that's something that, you know, I've talked about, like, previously on the show, the article that, or the link that he talks to about, you can't safely route payments smaller than 3.5 times the on-chain fee limit. What he's talking about there and what he links to is a thread some time ago, a couple months back, by Paul Zork, that Truthcoin on Twitter, which is a really, really great, like, way to visualize and think about the you know, the level of trust that's going on in Lightning, because if you're holding the HTLC, the payment that is happening over a Lightning channel, the data that needs to enforce that HTLC is a little over 3 times the amount of data of a regular transaction. So the fact that it is more data means, like, if you're talking about a per byte basis, it necessarily needs a, like the standard fee doesn't pay for it. It needs a, you know, 3x fee because it's a 3x the data cost to actually route that payment. And that is a problem to some degree. I mean, it's not a huge issue because, like, right now it is keeping data off of the main chain, which is keeping those fees low. But, you know, if you're routing a 1 Satoshi payment or a 10 Satoshi payment, like, you're trusting that someone's not going to cheat it, because, you know, there's never, it's like, it's been, that's below the dust limit already. You can't really take that to the Bitcoin blockchain and get that money back. But it's also like 1/100 of a cent or, you know, 1/10 of 1 penny. And when the cost, when the assurances of the Bitcoin system are based on the ability to validate a certain data set against a specific set of rules, the larger the data set, the larger the validation, the larger the cost of validating. And it is strictly because everybody has the ability to validate that it has any assurances. Now, the only way around this in, like, a payment channel that, you know, just kind of a theoretical point of view, is to actually have the HTLC, or the temporarily routed payment, to be included in the full amount, to simply update the whole amount already and have that be the ready and waiting update to the channel state. But that therein lies the issue with the time that it's valid. So you don't want the invoice to, you know, be good for 2 days. Like, if your channel, the time that your channel is actually taking to invoke the insurance clause, whatever it is, whatever the standard wait time for your channel is, you don't want every little payment that goes across it to also be valid for that full 2 days, which is essentially what that means. But this is why L2 is potentially an incredibly important update or change to this system. Like, there's still the trade-off potentially of, if you're eliminating the punishment clause, which the L2 system does, and you're just replacing it with a sequence of transactions, well, then, you know, the risk of trying to cheat a channel, which, you know, potentially you wouldn't open a channel with somebody you didn't trust to some degree anyway. But let's say, you know, you are just opening up with someone random, completely random on the chain. Well, there's very little risk in trying to defraud your channel if the cost of doing so is simply that the honest, like, end state, the final state, it just gets enforced. But then at the same time, you're cutting down on a huge amount of the risk in that, because you're just replacing old states with new states, and therefore changing the dynamic of the cost related in, or cost in order to route a payment or to update a channel in the first place. But in all of this is why I think the ability to create a decentralized means of aggregating data, of aggregating payments, aggregating channel open and closure on the network, the ability essentially to do the batching that banks do, that exchanges do, like all of these services, the ability to do that in a decentralized way, in a peer-to-peer fashion, where somebody can participate, and kind of in a similar way that the Wasabi coin join aggregates a bunch of people together, and they are trustlessly all adding their coins together, and they aren't trusting the mixer. Like, all of these aspects of the coin join, essentially we need to figure out a way. There needs to be a hyper focus on figuring out how to do that with batching and aggregation of you know, Lightning channels and stuff like with, again, with Taproot is another great example of how to compress that data as much as possible and then be able to aggregate it with other people and not have a potentially an adversary, an attacker come in and, you know, screw with the whole batch transaction by putting in invalid data. That there needs to be a way to do that, because if they can't compete, if the decentralized means of compressing that data cannot compete with the custodial bank, then there remains the potential of them being priced out of the base layer, out of the courtroom, essentially, to prove what they own, you know, potentially blacklisting or something like that could actually come back. By having all batching and aggregation of transaction data or ownership need some sort of trusted third party in order to, you know, actually get it on the chain. You know, but knowing this, like, I still, like there is this constant push and pull between the fees, the ability to validate, the ability to transact on these higher layers, and the ability to exit. Like, as one of these costs go up, you start putting pressure. It's amazing how many market incentives are actually leaning on each other and affect each other in this system. And I still firmly believe that this is the only way to really do it until we find some means of both compressing the data massively before having it actually transmitted, while not losing any of the ability to prove the integrity of the data inside of it, which I don't know the first idea of how that's even possible. But until that comes along, defending the monetary policy is the better of the two trade-offs. But we're going to need thousands of incremental improvements on figuring out, like, we're going to need constant work and, like, vigilant focus on those ideas, on the underlying principles of no IOUs, no custodian, no leaning on custodial control, because we know those can lead to systemic risk. They can create it's Mt. Gox at a higher layer in a bigger economy. But to lose the ability to validate, to lose the defense of the underlying money supply, is to lose everything. So even though Hasu and everybody gets tons of hate whenever they, really attack the potential and get really at the heart of some of the trust trade-offs that are in this, and I don't think it's, you know, black and white. And I never have. It is a choice between, you know, what is more valuable. And in this context, I do think we have more time. I think we can move slowly in a way that Hasu kind of dismisses in this article. And that's specifically because Bitcoin will be a avenue for trustless savings for a very, very long time before it actually becomes a money, before it can actually become the transactional currency. And I think the short term and midterm benefit of Lightning is actually to keep fees low. Because any time that there is pressure for the fees to rise, which, you know, makes or increases the cost of actually settling those transactions or settling that data to the base chain, well, it also increases the pressure to use something like Lightning to move up the layers for specifically where there is still a trustless or trust minimized relationship, Lightning being a great example. And that will then pull the pressure away and lower the fees on the base layer again. So if you can get a 10x, 20x improvement in transactional throughput by moving to Lightning, well, you're also inherently lowering the fees, which is making Lightning less trusted. So you're relieving pressure in the midterm and allowing incremental improvements to get us to that next step. But I don't think Lightning is an end game. Lightning is, Andreas has a great example or has a great statement. And he says, Bitcoin will scale, but it will always be behind what it needs to be. It will scale on a as we need it to, very much like the internet. Every time we thought it was going to break and we thought it wasn't going to scale, we managed to squeeze a little bit more out of it with multiple incremental improvements that compound on the previous improvements that have been made. But the ultimate long-term truth of this is that we do need fees on the base layer. But as Parker Lewis says in, I think it's Bitcoin is not too slow, that I think that's it, is that the payment system, the payment layer, is not the more difficult problem. The more difficult problem was the decentralized validation, was the trust independent system of monetary security. We solved the more difficult problem. Satoshi solved the more difficult problem. That doesn't mean there's not a huge problem left to solve. But I think we have the right direction, we have the right mindset, we have the right focus, and luckily we have people like Hasu, we have the developers knowing and thinking of these things adversarially and understanding the economics and the trade-offs of these. And I think we will solve it. I think we will figure it out. And Bitcoin is the closest, is the greatest tool for getting there that we have ever had. But there is anything but to say the work is done. There is a lot left to do, and it's going to be crazy. We're going to move into this third era, like Rusty Russell says. There will potentially be another civil war in Bitcoin. This is never going to be boring. The fee market will begin to mature. I expect to see, probably in the not too long term, derivatives for block space, like selling blocks, like futures on the validation of data to actually ease out and make us able to predict fees. Because right now we have really horrible mechanisms for doing so. But they're like, we know those markets. Like, we have market tools that we're just not utilizing, that we don't have liquidity liquidity for to actually pull that off in Bitcoin yet. But as miners, as the mining industry really becomes mature and financialized, we will have derivatives for block space. We will sell futures for confirming transactions that will level out and make prediction of fees far more reasonable, and the ability to hedge against the potential rise or fall of fees, whatever it is that whatever that fluctuation is, and will bring some sense of stability to that. Because right now we don't have a market for it. It's like market discovery is, like, that's the one thing that, something that the network doesn't do. There is no market discovery. It's just kind of it's a giant blind auction to some degree. And there's a lot of iteration that needs to be done to actually expand this out. We need a decentralized financial system on top of the decentralized money. This isn't going to be one protocol. This isn't going to be three protocols. This is going to be thousands of protocols in my thinking. But at the end of the day, I think that will settle on one money. That's the nature of money, and I think that's the nature of actually providing value to those protocols. Otherwise, it's just a spreadsheet. If your spreadsheet isn't moving something that is valuable, and in the digital space, the one asset of the greatest monetary value is going to be the one that's most certain as an asset. The rules are what make a Bitcoin, period. If you're not validating the rules, it's not a Bitcoin. You know nothing about that asset. You don't own the asset. The consensus rules of Bitcoin are its atomic structure. So, keep trying to kill this thing, I guess. Bitcoin, we just read Bitcoin is anti-fragile. The more ways we figure out how this thing could die, the more ways we figure out how it could potentially be, how its assurances could be undermined, how we could attack this system, and the more we focus on exactly the principles of mitigating those things, the stronger and longer lived this thing is. And Bitcoin is anti-fragile, and I think we are on a path to making this possible. You know, I'm incredibly optimistic. I love the thinking around all of this stuff, but I think the incentives are properly aligned, and you know, we'll see over the next decade how this plays out and how the technology is scaled. And I think there's going to be many more protocols and innovative ways to use the cryptography and to extend the trustlessness of the system that will be as fascinating and as unique as the Lightning Network itself. So, yeah, curious what you guys think. Is this the risk that Hasu lays it out to be? I think he's got a pretty good argument, and you know, it's a fascinating thought experiment. And you know, what do you see in the future of Bitcoin? How do you see this playing out? Do we solve this, or are we just kind of stuck? You know, are we static where we are today, and there won't be any major improvements in the use or the cryptography or the splitting up of keys or the splitting up of the ownership of a single UTXO in the future? Because I do think that that is absolutely critical to securing its assurances for as many people as possible in the future. Like, that is it. That is the problem. How do we make one UTXO and the unbelievable world-changing assurances of the ownership of that one UTXO? How do we split that among 1,000 people, 10,000 people? How do we make that happen? I think that is, or you know, of 1,000 transactions, 10,000 transactions, etc. You know, that's why I think Lightning Network is a first and critical step in moving us in that direction, and why even with 10 megabyte blocks, even with 100 megabyte blocks, that is the only thinking that makes any sense. Because those are drops in the ocean of the problem that we need to overcome. Align the incentives now and build as fast as we can go. So, yeah, let me know what you think. I hope you guys enjoyed this article. You can find Hasu on Twitter at H-A-S-U-F-L. I will link to that in the show notes so that you can check him out and all of the works that we have covered by him, and that he has done so many good pieces. With that, huge thank you to Hasu for this piece. I believe this is the first thing we've read on Deribit, if I'm not mistaken. Thank you to those guys for making this available. Don't forget 30% off for your BitBlock Boom tickets with offer code CC. And of course, if you have not started stacking with Swan Bitcoin, you can get $10 to start you off for free by going to swanbitcoin.com/guy and setting up your auto buy of Bitcoin every day, every week, every month, whatever it is. swanbitcoin.com/guy. All right, everybody. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time, take it easy, guys.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.